Mumi Abu-Jamal puts it. I'm going to need another sip of coffee. Got a short segment from Gloria LaRiva. I'm going to email the producer out at Flashpoint's Kevin Pena about why he didn't have her on longer. She's been down to Cuba a couple times in the last quarter month. I'm going to kick it with something I do every sort of military remembrance day, and that's Smedley Butler. Got a Nation interview with conducted by Jeet Heer. He is, I think, Dutch Indonesian extraction. It's JEETHEER. He writes for The Nation and has a podcast called In the Time of Monsters. And I've got a segment that's about the CIA in Mexico. Obviously, the Trump acknowledged that we've got CIA people on the ground in Cuba this week again. He's not supposed to say that. I'm going to be around for a couple of extra hours because I'm going to have the contingent from Radio Free Labor in, but Gus has some hard appointment at noon, so Stephanie Portato and I will be hanging out for the midday hour, 12 to 1, then Radio Eco Shock. Coming up as part of this, the rotating programming. The great show Counterspin rotates too. It's only on twice a month, every other. And I like to point out what was on today's episode. But maybe I'll do that if I can remember right after we. Here, the underwriting announcement, which we're starting at the top. And oh gosh. What else can I say? I already gave sort of a disclaimer. If you have that eyesore vehicle like I'm hiding in my garage, you can donate it to Weth Through Car Easy. I had some other announcements at hand, but let's try and figure out why this USB won't boot up. There we go. Turn it over to Rick for the underwriting announcement. We'll kick off the show. I kind of did a rundown of everything I'm intending to play. I had about four other things to sort out and decide about. I was going to play the Electronic Intifada's roundup of the news this week, but got pushed down. Maybe I'll put that on tomorrow. That's Nora Barrows Friedman project, along with Ali Abu Nima, though she is the voice of it these days.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and online sessions. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That's ELLIOTT Counseling Group, no punctuation or spaces.com, or by phone at 217-398-9066.
So we'll kick it with Smedley Butler, and it's kind of poignant about where he ends on the idea of having disarmament conferences and peace conferences. It was a big thing in the interregnum between World War I and World War II. Smedley Butler, my favorite veteran.
I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service, and during that period, I spent most of my time as a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Mexico safe for American oil interests. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the International Banking House of Brown Brothers. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the American sugar interests. I helped make Honduras right for the American fruit companies. In China, I helped see to it that Standard Oil went on its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best that he could do was operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents. War is a racket. It always has been. A few profit and the many pay. But there is a way to stop it. You can end it by disarmament conferences. It can be smashed effectively only by taking the profit out of war.
Taking the profit out of war. I forgot it ended on that note. Smedley Butler. War is a Racket, small pamphlet that he wrote, delivered at a VFW hall, actually. I think that's the original recording. There are some dramatizations that fill it out a little bit you can find if you want to listen to that again. There's a full-length book called Gangster for Capitalism by whose name I can't remember right now. All right, Mumia's got a longer than typical. He's under 3 minutes, but this is four and a half or so. And then still kind of on the fly, or just under 4 minutes. Breaking the Sound Barrier essay by Amy Goodman used to be a regular feature. I'm hoping comes back. It's now said to be on hiatus while she's around the country debuting her and the continent, actually. I think she went abroad once, too, the film about Democracy Now, Steal This Story, Please. And there's a rumor that there will be a screening that the Film Society locally is going to run in town. So keep your eyes open for that. I think it'll be a one-off. It won't be a series. Maybe I'm wrong on that. I would be happy if it was run over a period of a weekend or something, or longer. Anyway, here's Mumia Abu-Jamal with a eulogy to a comrade.
Khalid Rahim makes his transition. The name Khalid Rahim may not ring many bells, but to those who knew him, his life was one of lifelong struggle for the black nation as a revolutionary, as a Muslim convert, and as a prisoner deeply enmeshed within Pennsylvania's mass incarceration system. Rahim was also a skillful writer whose 2021 book, Panthers That Make Salat, recounts the struggles of former members of the Black Panther Party who struggled in prison across the state from the early 1970s to the mid-1980s. They faced repression, beatings, long-term lockdowns, and onerous sentences. Rahim typified the deep influence of Malcolm X upon Panther and other black revolutionary groups who embraced Islam as he did. Rahim wrote of days of rebellion, resistance, of revolutionary resistance as a Panther and also a political prisoner at Holmesburg, at Greaterford State Prison, Huntington State Prison, Waymart State Prison, and back to Greaterford, known in the old days as the Farm. As he did time for robberies to bring resources to revolutionary movements, as he would say, he saw the emergence and expansion of what we now call mass incarceration. He was young and therefore receptive to the rebelliousness and passions of youth, naturally, under prisons inherit repression. He rebelled, and he rebelled constantly. He got thrown into the hole. He got transferred to other prisons. And lastly, he was transferred to Western, a penitentiary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. There he met old heads from Holmesburg and Greaterford. He continued to try to utilize his political teachings as a Panther and his spiritual teachings as a Muslim. He spent over a decade in the joint. He was released in 1984 and later settled in Pittsburgh, where he worked on peace initiatives among street gangs. He founded the New African Independence Party there. I didn't know him as Rahim, but I did know him as a member of the Black United Liberation Front in Philadelphia, the BULF, led by former Panther Captain Reggie Shell. In fact, I met him at BULF headquarters on Columbia Avenue when he was known as Bird. He was as thin as a minute, with a youthful face and a laugh that bounced off the walls. That youthful face lives in memory. Khalid Rahim, revolutionary, writer, believer, and community organizer and activist, returns to the source with love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
He's been pretty regular lately. There are quite a few other people that are posting at Prison Radio, prisonradio.org. I guess I'll start with Camilo Bustillo and Dennis Bernstein, who's been in and out of the studio chair with some open heart surgery, but he sounds pretty vibrant. Yeah, kind of a broad view. Again, I'm going to go to the CIA in Mexico from a Nation article, our podcast, In the Time of Monsters, with Jeet Hero mentioned. I'm going to him for some of his Nation's articles on Epstein, parts that aren't in the corporate press. None dare call it mainstream. But, yeah. Epstein as warlord, making arms deals. That's a different way of looking at him. I'll tell you, trying to write about Epstein is, there's just so much stuff. Curiously, he was thought of as a crypto specialist or analyst in the Obama Treasury Department. Turned to him to inquire about how crypto could be used to get around sanctions. Got to ask a crook how money launderers do it, I guess. This was while he was agitating for an attack on Iran, like finally happened. All right, here's Dennis Bernstein with Camilo. And there's a colleague of Dennis Bernstein, a poet out in the Bay Area, also on board on this segment from Flashpoints from, the 19th, beginning of the week.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are honored to be joined by our good brother Camilo Perez Bustillo. He has been moving around the atmosphere, fighting for the people. He's a former executive director of the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. He has been deeply engaged in teaching, consciousness raising, and recently traveling around the hemisphere, finding out what's going on, collaborating, organizing, doing the incredible work that needs to be done. And also joining us is our good brother, our senior producer Miguel Gavilán Molina. Camilo, let's start, though. We must start with Cuba. I want to get your feedback on what is happening. The United States is busy trying to starve the Cuban people and undermine the revolution. Is that an exaggeration?
Dennis, it's so good to be on with you and at such a critical moment. And I think what's incredible is, you know, we're right now commemorating throughout Latin America 50 years of what was known as Operation Condor. You know, if we look back, you know, it was the Church Committee in the U.S. that, you know, released the classified records that revealed what had been done in the name of the people of the U.S. to the peoples of Latin America, you know, the subversion of democratic governments, like the government, of course, of Allende in Chile. And what we're seeing now is what is being done openly that was then being done in secret. You know, when we see the director of the CIA flying publicly, openly to Cuba to do in public what was being done then, you know, under wraps, you know, behind closed doors. And so I think that that sort of takes a measure of how far we've traveled and how backward we've gone in terms of the kinds of standards and conduct that the U.S. government is engaged in now openly. You know, the open extortion of the government of Cuba, of course, but that's simply tracking and, you know, it's simply echoing what's been going down in Venezuela since early the morning of January 3rd. You know, of course, the intervention, invasion, and kidnapping of its president and the president's wife, who was also a high-level official, a deputy in Venezuela's parliament, Celia Flores, in addition to its then-president, Nicolas Maduro, on, you know, hashed-up drug charges being currently held and, you know, on trial in New York. The same thing is being planned, of course, confabulated against none other than Raul Castro. That's part of the headline, the story about Cuba. That's part of what's being, you know, cooked up as we speak as a supposed, you know, justification in quotes for whatever may come down around Cuba. The same is being held in abeyance against the current president of Colombia, Gustavo Petro, who was put, of course, on the watch list for supposed money laundering as a background to the extortion and coercion that the Trump administration has been trying to wield against Colombia and its people's sovereignty. And this is very important to underline as we're less than 2 weeks away, just 12 days away, in fact, today on May 19th, from the May 31st first round of the upcoming presidential elections in Colombia to determine what comes next as Petro serves out his term. There are elections coming up in Peru on June 7th, only a week after Colombia. There are very important elections coming up in Brazil. So, you know, you kind of opened up, you know, this segment saying that we were going to kind of do an overview of the hemisphere. Of course, it's very important. We began, as you did, with Cuba. But every single other instance that I've mentioned is part of this broader pattern. What already went down with the elections in Honduras and the pardon for its former president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, the convicted drug runner. In that case, all of the evidence was very clear about his involvement in essentially running a cartel from the presidency in Honduras. And yet somehow he was on the right side of the President Trump and on the right side of history. And somehow Petro and Maduro and others are on the wrong side. So it's very clear how arbitrary these lines are. So we've got a new Operation Condor being run from the White House, and we've got an unprecedented intensity and unprecedented directness of U.S. intervention, which is, of course, accompanied officially by the reactivation and revival of the Monroe Doctrine through the national security strategy that was unveiled late last year. And just within the last 10 days, we had the unveiling not just of the DEA's new drug control strategy, but also, and even more importantly, because it came directly from the White House, presented personally by Trump, we had the new counterterrorism strategy. And this is where Mexico comes in, where, of course, I'm currently based, because we have to add Mexico to the list that I've been seeking to summarize, because all of this is about a hemispheric and a global strategy. And where do we connect the dots? It's Mexico that, for the first time in modern U.S. history, is front and center as a target, not just in terms of the national security strategy, but also the counterterrorism strategy and the drug control strategy, which means Mexico's next on the list.
That is the voice of Camila Perez Bustillo. You can understand why we are delighted and focused on having him on this broadcast to enlighten our community. And just say, before we bring in Miguel Gavilán Molina, please remind people, for those who don't understand the history, you say Operation Condor, you say the Monroe Doctrine. These are longstanding structures to make sure that the United States has the access, if you will, to sucking the resources out of Central and South America. Remind people, just a moment of history here.
You know, what we have to think about, you know, when we talk about the U.S. and Latin America is, you know, how, you know, U.S. foreign policy becomes essentially a strategy to ensure that U.S. interests are defended at all costs by any means. You know, anybody who's seen the Godfather trilogy, you know, an offer you can't refuse, particularly part two, which is set primarily in and around events in Cuba leading up to and during and in the wake of the Cuban Revolution. You know, when Cuba was being run as essentially, you know, an operation for the mafia in the U.S., that's what I'm referring to. It's the dark side of U.S. foreign policy that Richard Cheney activated post 9/11. But it's all of that within the context of the Cold War. So when we talk about the Cold War, you know, people normally don't put Latin America at the center of the landscape. You know, they think about Eastern Europe. They think about, you know, the Berlin Wall. But when we look at the history of the Cold War from the perspective of Latin America, we put Latin America at the center. We think about Chile in September of 1973. We say that there was an other September 11th, because ironically enough, of course, there was September 11th, 2001. But before there was 2001, you know, 9/11, there was September 11th, 1973, ironically the same date according to the calendar, but, you know, decades before, when the democratically elected socialist center-left government of Salvador Allende was overthrown in a bloody military coup orchestrated from the White House under the Nixon administration, directly by Henry Kissinger and what was known as the 40 Committee, September 1973, at the height of the Cold War. And this is the kind of operation that the U.S. used to run throughout Latin America, imposing U.S.-backed military dictatorships that eventually dominated the entire hemisphere. It began in Brazil in 1964, several years before Chile, but it eventually blanketed the entire subcontinent of Latin America. Dictatorships run directly or indirectly from the U.S. to protect U.S. corporate interests. This culminated in the 1980s, of course, in the civil wars that ravaged Central America, that included genocide in Guatemala, over 200,000 dead, primarily indigenous people, but also hundreds of thousands in Nicaragua, where there was another democratic revolution that was ultimately swallowed and squandered in blood through the Contra Revolution led by U.S.-backed forces in 1990, and in El Salvador, the bloody civil war throughout the 1980s. So again, the most important, let's say, theater that people don't know about of the Cold War was Latin America, and that's what I'm referring to when we say that that's what we're essentially going back to now. But then it was run primarily through clandestine operations, and now it's being done publicly, such as the CIA director flying down to Cuba and saying, either you submit, you surrender, or we invade and we impose our will.
You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to bring in Miguel Gavilan Molina now, but I just want to say that these covert operations that the United States supported were often funded by illegal drug flows. And wherever the CIA was, that's where the drug of choice was. So let's not forget that when we think about so-called drug wars. Gavilan Molina, please join us welcoming Camilo into this discussion.
Absolutely. As always, Camilo, it's always so important to be able to talk with you, because the information and the flow that you give us, you know, it not only educates, but empowers and inspires. And in all those lines, you know, one of the things that I'm really concerned about Cuba, and that's that lately we know what media is. It's a great stage. News has become, entertainment. But I've heard for the last week of the, all of a sudden, it seems like Cuba's armed with, you know, an army of drones. They could possibly, you know, threaten Miami. And I go, what? ¿Qué? You know, that's what I'm hearing and seeing. And then on the flip side of that, the whole idea that, you know, the invasion of Cuba, in some ways, Camilo and Dennis, I think that United States is already in Guantanamo Bay. It already has, you know, it's basically naval force. I mean, so in taking Cuba, it would, you know, the resistance, it would be interesting to see that. Away from that, my second question is, Camilo, and that is, the talk again coming out of the Oval Office, the White House, and that is, you know, the I call him the insane king, the dictator want to be in the House, has been, you know, saying that, hey, how about annexing, you know, Venezuela, making it the 51st state? What do you think about those things, you know, those statements?
You know, I think what's incredible is, you know, as we speak, it's the 200th anniversary, this July, actually, of when Simón Bolívar called for, in effect, a continental Latin American Congress for all of the countries that had emerged from, you know, the Latin American struggle for emancipation from Spain to unite against what he was already identifying then. 200 years ago, in 1826, June of 1826, as the emerging threat to those newly emergent independent nations of Latin America. Simón Bolívar, okay? You know, in effect, the George Washington and Lincoln combined of Latin America, because not only did he free those nations from foreign domination, in our case of Spain, but he also freed the slaves. So that's why I include Lincoln in the equation, you know, way before the U.S. did so. So the reason I'm sort of invoking that historical memory is Bolívar's call in that summer of 1826 for Latin American unity against what he already identified as the emerging threat of what we now understand to be U.S. imperialism, right? 1826, 20 years before the U.S., you know, found an excuse to invade and conquer half of Mexican territory. That's how we have sort of a population of Mexican origin inside the U.S. That's how we got here, right? The border crossed us. We didn't cross the border, right? That's the origin of a Chicano nation and Chicano movement in the U.S. and so on. You know, that's how we get here. You know, the harvest of empire, as Juan Gonzalez called it in his very, very powerful and essential book. Go back to that moment of 1826. What was Bolívar responding to? He was responding to the Monroe Doctrine, which had been issued in December of 1823. So again, that's why history is helpful to us. It's not just dates and names in a textbook. And that's why we have to fight for our children to learn this history on both sides of the border. It's not just names and dates in a textbook. It's references for us to understand the ground on which we stand, the roots from which we come, and the direction in which we might be headed. Which way the wind is blowing, as Bob Dylan once wrote, right? And so that call in 1826 is more relevant today, perhaps, and more timely than it was then. Bolívar said, you know, in Spanish, the essence of his phrase is that the United States of America appears destined to plague us with tribulations in the name of freedom, and we need to respond with the unity of our peoples.
Carmen, Camilo Perez Bustillo on Flashpoints from the 19th. I'm gonna leave that quote hang in the air. Manifestly destined, apparently. And it reminds me of the quote, it's often attributed to Jefferson, but apparently he shared the idea, but Adams actually penned it, that Cuba was a ripe fruit that would fall into our hands. Well, they're still hoping for that. Halfway through the show, opinions you hear are those of the speakers. Now we're going to go to Gloria La Riva. I had an occasion to meet her when she was doing her Eyewitness Venezuela tour some years ago, chronicling some of U.S. machinations there. At the time, it's been quite a while. Also got to vote for her for president once on the PSL ticket. Didn't need to waste my vote on somebody who was going to win overwhelmingly. All right. I just gave a disclaimer. Here is Gloria La Riva in conversation with Kevin Pena.
Back to Flashpoints on Pacifico Radio. Well, you're probably hearing all the doublespeak around Cuba. You're probably hearing, again, the demonization of yet another Latin American leader. In this case, it's Raul Castro. We know that the Trump administration has been putting a full court press to squeeze the life out of the people of Cuba, to destroy what has been a light to the world that many of us have supported over the years. Now joining us to talk about that is Gloria La Riva. Gloria, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
Well, let's go ahead and let's start. I mean, it's I can't believe at this point that once again they're getting away with this demonization crap, right? The mainstream media is lapping it up like a cat to warm milk in a bowl when it comes to the lies of the CIA and Trump State Department, particularly Marco Rubio. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely. Marco Rubio is over the top thinking that he can address the Cuban people as he has today, urging them to join with the United States. The long history of the U.S., from even before 1898, when the U.S. took over Cuba, Puerto Rico, Philippines, and Guam, after the pretext that they created with the explosion of a USS Maine in a Havana harbor, knowing that Spain hadn't exploded the ship, but it was still the excuse for the U.S., which had longed to take over Cuba, and they longed to take it back again. But in addition, the rest of the world, but from Gaza, we can't forget what's going on worldwide. It has found it unable to do it in Iran, but this is a very dangerous time for Cuba. It is the prelude to what could very well be in the next days, hours even, a military attack on Cuba. They think that they're probably thinking they can do similar to what they did with kidnapping President Nicolas Maduro. But the Cubans have said, from the leadership to the people that I met when I was there 10 days ago, that they said, we will fight, and we will fight, and we'll die if we have to, but we will defend our country. And I heard a lot of people in the streets. I was there for May Day and days after, where people I met in restaurants and elsewhere in the street, they go, we are not afraid. And they're telling the U.S., we may not have, like, the kind of weapons you have that you wage against people, but we have our spirit and our determination and their history, the history of what it was like. I want to remind people maybe who don't know who Raul Castro is. He was 22 years old, just having turned 22 in June, when he and his brother Fidel and a number of other men and two heroic women took on the Batista regime on July 26, 1953. And his particular acts of bravery at that time as this very young man, and what they did time and again until they achieved victory to overthrow the hated Batista regime, which had killed 20,000 people in 7 years. The U.S. never complained. And as far as this charge, this false charge of murder, I want to direct people to an excellent statement on liberationnews.org from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. And it points out that the shoot down of February 24, 1996, Cuba had warned repeatedly, stop these flights that are buzzing the buildings of Havana. They were like actually over Havana streets at the site, at the height of buildings, throwing out leaflets. And one of the Cuban five, those five men who spent a total of 78 years in U.S. prison for having peacefully defended Cuba against these kind of terrorists, Rene Gonzalez was infiltrated into the Brothers to the Rescue, which were buzzing Cuban buildings, that they were building bombs and they were planning to create attacks, armed attacks, and to destroy electrical power plants. So this was all known. It was reported to the FBI by the Cuban government because they thought maybe they could cooperate, and instead the FBI arrested the Cuban five anti-terrorists.
Right.
And at the same time those men were in prison, the two most notorious terrorists of the Western Hemisphere, Orlando Bosch and Luis Posada Carriles, which among their many crimes as CIA agents, had bombed the Cuban airliner in 1976, 20 years earlier, and they killed 73 people with their bombs, and they ended up spending the rest of their lives in Miami, treated as heroes in Miami, and Clinton and Obama and Bush refused to deport them to the crime scene of Venezuela where they carried out the bombing.
Well, let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of our guest, Gloria LaRiva. We're going to have to leave it there. Unfortunately, we ran out of time.
And welcome.
Kevin Pena should have had a couple more questions for Gloria LaRiva. We're going to keep it moving. 10:37 or so. Already played my Smedley Butler for Memorial Day. Why don't we get, Camilo Perez Bustillo mentioned that Mexico is in the targets, too. I noticed, I've been listening a lot of the business news. There's a lot of propaganda, but every now and then they report something that you don't hear on the mainstream press. And one thing I heard recently is that Moody's has just downgraded Mexico's credit rating to just one step over junk. So I presume there's some economic machinations going on against Mexico. Mexico had been sending oil to Cuba, but they have been strong-armed into not doing it. Turkey has a power plant ship across on the border of Mexico. I didn't know there was such a thing exists, but it's a floating power plant. And I guess it has to go to Mexico to get refueled because the armed blockade, which is an act of war against Cuba, that's stopping oil shipments there, might stop the oil tanker that would be going to refuel the Turkish floating power plant. Oh, my. So In the Time of Monsters, quote from Gramsci, that's the name of Jeet Heer's podcast. I mentioned again his writing on Epstein is different from a lot of other folks because it looks at him as a warlord and as an international fixer, and not enough of that. And, of course, as an agent for Mossad, or perhaps, as some people are putting it, Ryan Grimm, notably of Dropsite, that Mossad worked for Epstein, not vice versa. All right, Jeet Heer, a Dutch Indonesian, I think, is what his extraction is, J-E-E-T-H-E-E-R. I'll let him introduce the guest who's an academic at ASU in Arizona, and talking about CIA assassinations in Mexico. It's all part of the great drug war against the narco terrorists. Goes into the history of that. I won't be playing all of this, but it's about 40 minutes long. But I did want to get the first 20 minutes or so on, so I'll do that right now. And I'll be hanging around chatting with Stephanie, maybe playing some Tom Morello. I don't know if she fancies him. I know we'll be doing a fair amount of music in the second hour. Gus is in for an hour, but he's going to a freedom school, which sounds like a great idea, at the noon hour.
Get rewarded just for shopping with...
Forgot to delete the podcast ad, come to think of it. And again, Jeet here of The Nation, In the Time of Monsters. It's the name of the podcast.
Deals from brands you love all in. Join today.
Oh, damn.
For details. This Memorial Day.
What else can I say? I knew I forgot something today. Pregnant pause.
Without compromise, using high quality organic materials that bring
without compromise
and support into perfect.
My, they have long ads for their podcasts.
Experience that your body will.
Oh, geez. That's why I need to get my computer that I usually broadcast from back in. I could slew forward much easier. Okay.
Automattress.com.
Hi, welcome to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm Jeet here of The Nation magazine, which is the sponsor of this podcast. There's a lot going on in the world, obviously with the continuing conflict between the United States and Iran in the Middle East and Donald Trump's visit to China. But I don't think we should ignore a very startling CNN report that appeared alleging that the CIA has ramped up activities in Mexico and is involved with targeted assassinations of figures they describe as members of Mexican drug cartels. And this report in CNN, which I'll link to in the show notes, has been denied by the CIA in very interesting terms, saying that it endangers Americans. And also has been met with great anger by the president of Mexico, Claudia Sheinbaum, partially because it makes it look like there's a unilateral American action being conducted in her country without her knowledge. So I think the whole thing, is a very dangerous escalation and really sheds a light into the sort of larger issues of American foreign policy under Donald Trump. To talk about this, I'm very happy to have on Alexander Avinia, who is an associate professor of Latin American history at Arizona State University and has sort of written in the past about what we might call American counterinsurgency in the region, which I think this is very much a part of that tradition, a tradition that has led to in the past like enormous violence. And I think that's something that can maybe help us understand both what is happening and also I think the grave dangers. So first of all, thank you for being on the program.
No, thank you so much for inviting me. Happy to be here.
So yeah, let's just first rehearse the story for listeners. What exactly is being reported by CNN and why is it so startling?
So the report that CNN put out, I think a couple days ago now, alleges that there is an intense and expanded CIA operation on the ground inside Mexico that looks very much like war on terror operations in West Asia, where the CIA operatives or assets are assassinating mid-level in Mexico, they're alleging that they're assassinating mid-level cartel operators. So like kind of like the middle management of narco trafficking organizations, trying to go after finance guys, the guys who really make some of these organizations run, right? Not the more famous kingpins, and not necessarily the ground level soldiers or even like the smuggling mules, but going after middle management. And this was sparked by an assassination that happened, I think, a couple months ago, where somebody who's alleged to have belonged to a narco trafficking organization was car bombed in central Mexico. And the CNN report alleges that it was a CIA ground team that was responsible for it, if I remember correctly. Yesterday, we got a New York Times report soon thereafter who made the suggestion that it was Mexican government security forces who are actually conducting some of these operations, and that CIA folks are kind of hanging out in the background providing support and intelligence. So we have two different reportings on this issue. What is concerning, though, is that we have, and we can talk about this, not the first time that CIA has been in Mexico, but it seems that we do have a more aggressive presence of the CIA on the ground in Mexico, waging war on terror style operations and tactics, but applying them to people that they've identified as narco-terrorists. And that is becoming, I mean, we saw it with the kidnapping of President Nicolás Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, earlier this year, right? But narco-terrorism since last year, since Trump came into office again, has become the frame through which they're using to justify and expand U.S. imperial control over the region. And what we're witnessing in Mexico now is a very sensitive theater in which they are trying to operate secretly, but no longer after these two reports came out.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things you said there that are kind of worth unpacking. I think the larger theoretical framework is that what one is seeing is a merging of two instruments of American power. One is a sort of war on terrorism, and the other is a war on drugs, and both of which have like sort of like, you know, long histories. And in some ways, I guess the tactics that have been developed on the sort of global war on terrorism, particularly in the Middle East, are, you know, now being fused with the sort of war on drugs. And the other issue is like, you know, the extent of sort of CIA involvement, and, you know, like obviously, like with, you know, these spooks, one always has a level of plausible deniability. And certainly there's been a long history of the CIA, like, you know, working with like local police or military in these regions, often training them, which itself is kind of like, you know, fueled escalation. But I mean, like, whether they're like, you know, the ones like, you know, pressing the button on the bomb or just standing next to the guy who's pressing the button seems to be like a little bit irrelevant. What was more notable is that, yeah, I mean, the CIA is involved. And also, I mean, the third strand from what you said is that this is like a real political problem for the Mexican government and for Mexican-American relations, you know, given the past history of this and sort of, you know, like understandable sensitivities about national sovereignty, right? So is that like, are these the three major kind of issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think one way, and I've written and talked about this in the past, one way to understand what Trump and the Trump administration has in mind for all of the Western Hemisphere and Latin America, and particularly in the Caribbean, is that they're trying to meld these three, what they would refer to as three wars, right? War on drugs, war on terror, and war on migrants. And it's conflating these three wars and forming it into one logic that I think helps us connect and explain why they kidnapped Maduro, why they've assassinated nearly 200 people in the Eastern Pacific or the Caribbean who were simply on boats. We don't know if they were trafficking drugs or not. We have, you know, pretty good evidence that many of them were not trafficking drugs, but nonetheless, they were killed by, you know, U.S. air power or drones. It also helps us understand what the U.S. is doing in Ecuador right now, right? On the helping the Ecuadorian military conduct raids against people who they claim are narco-terrorists, but subsequent reporting in one instance said that it was dairy farmers who were captured and tortured for no reason, right?
Yeah.
So in the Mexican case, we can go back, man, but like this, a lot of this has to do with kind of fringe right wing Republican politician discourse from the 2010s that started to talk about Mexico as a failed state, that we should designate Mexican drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, and maybe like people like Louis Gohmert, right? Like that Texas representative from the 2010s. But these ideas essentially became more mainstream within the Republican Party by the time we get to like the 2023 presidential primary, where they're all these candidates were trying to outdo themselves on the stage by saying, I'll bomb Mexico, I'll send special force. It was like this total like Taylor Sheridan Sicario like fever dream, right? Which is now like becoming standard operating procedure, apparently. But the CIA in Mexico has had a long presence. During the Cold War, it had one of the biggest, if not the biggest, presences in the world in Mexico City. Kind of also because the KGB had a pretty big presence. So Mexico City was like this global crossroads of the Cold War.
KGB, like they did assassinate, or the precursor did assassinate Trotsky in Mexico. So
we could also talk about that.
sort of espionage there. And listeners of this particular podcast, what might remember our earlier discussions of William F. Buckley, who, when he was a CIA agent, was in Mexico City. And I believe his handler was E. Howard Hunt, who was a notorious figure involved with all sorts of CIA history, including the coup in Guatemala, the Bay of Pigs, and the Watergate break-in. So there's, that sort of whole, and as well as Oswald's or visitation of the embassy in Mexico and how he was monitored. Mexico has been actually like a major site of Cold War intrigue of the sort of the highest level.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think E. Howard Hunt has one of those terrible quotes from when he's describing what they did in Guatemala in 1954, where he said, we were trying to bomb them and use terror tactics from the air, like we were Stuka bombers. We're like, oh, you don't like, well, you guys are admitting you're American Nazis. But we now know that like at least four Mexican presidents from the late 50s to their early 80s were all CIA assets or informants. They were on the payroll. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the characteristics of Mexican history, particularly after the revolution of 1910, is that, and as you suggested earlier, right, because of shared history with the U.S., the question of sovereignty, political, economic, and like geographic sovereignty is really, it's key to any sort of political configuration in Mexico. So we've had this public appearance of a, throughout the 20th, and we still see it to this day, we have these very strong public affirmations by political leaders that Mexico is a sovereign nation, that they would never allow the U.S. to do things on the ground that would somehow undermine their definition of sovereignty. And that's a marker of throughout the 20th century, particularly during the Cold War. Even as you have four CIA asset Mexican presidents, publicly they're saying, we are, you know, non-aligned nation, we are anti-imperialist, we're revolutionary, we're anti-US. But secretly, we now know, we have like declassified conversations, for instance, between President Luis Echeverria, who was in there from the late 60s to early 70s, talking to Richard Nixon saying, look, if the US doesn't back me, then the banner of revolution and progress in Latin America will be carried by Fidel Castro. So either you guys work with me or you work with Fidel. And we do have a lot of evidence now that Mexico was essentially spying on Cuba and passing that information along to the U.S. During the 80s, the CIA in Mexico was working with Mexico's dreaded secret police, the DFS, Dirección Federal de Seguridad. They were, you know, their expertise was to torture and disappear people that they identified as communist or guerrillas. But they're also a really important player in the development of the transnational political economy of narcotics in Mexico. So you have instances in the 80s where the DEA is going after certain DFS police agents because they were either involved in drugs or auto smuggling rings. And the CIA would intervene and be like, no, those are our assets. Leave them alone. They're great anti-communist fighters. Yeah. We're kind of going to look the other way if they're stealing cars in San Diego and LA and then driving them into Mexico. Or if they're somehow involved in the drug trade with Central American figures or the Colombians. The CIA just has the CIA, when we say those things, it conjures a really nefarious, dark history, in, not just Mexico, but really in the Latin American past. I think this is one of the reasons why it's about the issue of Mexican sovereignty that's really touched off a firestorm about this latest report. But it's also because like when you see the CIA as a Latin American, like it speaks to a really dark, sordid, in certain countries, genocidal history, that the CIA was somehow involved with, whether directly or indirectly.
I don't know. And you sort of brought up the, very interesting sort of contradiction of the American role, because, on the one hand, you had, one wing of the American government that's like very concerned with narcotics trafficking and the war, you know, war on drugs, which has become since the 70s, you know, a bigger and bigger part of American foreign policy. And you had like another wing, which for its own reasons, like, you know, found it very useful to work with drug dealers. And in some ways, I mean, like that sort of dialectic or contradiction plays itself out in operational terms as well. Like, isn't it the case that, like, you know, through the escalation of the war on drugs and the sort of training of police and military in Mexico and other countries, the United States has actually like enabled the drug trade, because it's this bigger situation where, you know, they also have greater access to weapons and greater military technology and training.
You get the phenomenon of like counter narcotic narcos, which is like, you know, it's goes back to the 1970s. I mean, I think the dialectic that you mentioned is really interesting, because the way that they resolve it to produce a synthesis, I guess, in the 80s, you start to see the development of the term narco-terrorism. And it was actually the guy who coined it is actually a predecessor of mine. He was gone by the time I got to Arizona State, but he was a historian at Arizona State, Lewis Tams, who was also a really prominent figure of the Committee of Santa Fe, prominent neocon. He was ambassador to Costa Rica and Colombia under Reagan. And actually he had to testify in the Iran-Contra scandal, because when he was ambassador to Costa Rica, he was somehow involved with those Southern Front Contra fighters. Mm. Anyway, he's the one who started to talk about narco-terrorism as a way to meld that contradiction, right? To say, okay, we need to figure out, we're going to think about anti-communism as anti-terrorism because of the Sandinistas, because of the PLO. And then we can just throw in the Kremlin and say it's the Kremlin who are kind of pulling the strings. But then they added the narco part, right? So it's almost like someone like Lewis Tams was anticipating the winding down of the Cold War as a framework that would justify U.S. empire in Latin America, and was hinting at a post-Cold War order or justifying ideological framework to both understand Latin America and then apply U.S. power. Which eventually what happens, right? In the 90s, it's that idea of narco-terrorism that becomes bipartisan, and that leads to things like Plan Colombia, where under the Clinton administration and then George W. Bush, they send billions of dollars to the Colombian government, ostensibly to fight drugs. But what they're doing is they're fighting these long-standing guerrilla movements in Colombia while backing a Colombian military and security force apparatus that are, one, involved in the narco trade, and two, also committing horrific human rights violations. So when Trump comes in last year and starts talking about narco terrorism, that was I immediately thought of Lewis Tams, and I thought about this unipolar moment in the 1990s is how that became the justifying framework for U.S. empire. It gets kind of pushed aside because of the war on terror, 9/11. But then in the 2000s, you have these weird connections where you have congressional investigations that try to tie like the Sinaloa cartel to like Hamas because of tunnels, or MS-13 and Al-Qaeda working together. Just insane, right? And Hezbollah gets thrown in there with Hugo Chavez. But it's come back, and it's become the way that I think Trump is trying to justify both policies toward Latin America and the Caribbean, but then also to justify the crackdown that we see domestically with this ethnic cleansing campaign against migrants. And that's it's a really interesting way for them to connect the domestic and the exterior, at least in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, no.
That's Alex Avina at ASU, as he mentioned. And it's on a segment, it's part of the CIA assassination campaign in Mexico with Jeet here. The Time of Monsters. It's a Nation magazine podcast, and I recommend the next 20 minutes too, but I've run out of time. It's time for Radio Free Labor. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers. It's a wide-ranging and gets into all sorts of Latin American politics, echoing the Bolivarian reference that was made earlier in my year, and that was from Flashpoints with Camilo Perez Bustillo, if you came in on the end of that one. Time for an underwriting announcement. We'll get to a small business, and then we'll kick off Radio Free Labor on WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio. My name is Paul Muth, and I'll be hanging around and hanging out with Stephanie for a bit. Let's hear... kick it with Funkadelic shortly.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. Whether you need signs for an event, thousands of full-color flyers, or personalized promotional items, Minuteman Press can make it happen in time and on budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Minuteman Press may be reached online at cuprinting.com, by calling 217-355-0500, or in person at their new location in the Shop